And we're live with our 333rd episode of Absolute AppSec. I'm Ken Johnson at CK Tricky on social media, joined by my co-host Seth Law at Seth Law on social media. Seth, say hi.
Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode. Excited to be back as always. As you can see, this week it's just Ken and I talking through a few things that have happened over the last week or so. We do have a guest coming on, I want to say next week, if I remember right, Ken.
I think
And
so.
then, yeah. But just a couple of housekeeping items. I'll bring that up. I don't have it in front of me right now. We'll bring it up before the end of the episode. A couple of housekeeping items. There is the opportunity to take our AI Enhanced Application Security Black Hat Edition training at Black Hat Europe. That's December, I want to say 6th and 7th, something like that. Don't hold me to it too much. Might be 7th and 8th. And let me drop the, oh, I guess it is 7th and 8th. There you go. Let me drop the link in here. So Ken and I are on par for that. We are also talking about a agentic AppSec harnessing LLMs course that we'll probably be running remotely online, right? Saw an error there. If you are interested in that, please reach out to one of us either via Slack or via email or info at absoluteappsec.com. We're just trying to gauge, who would like that course, whether your company would like to send some people to it or you would like to jump into it, and the dates that make sense, so that we can fill up a course and teach people how to do the agentic AppSec stuff. So take a look at that. Besides that, this episode is sponsored by GuardSquare. So think about your mobile app's source code. Once it hits the App Store, it's out in the wild, and without the right protection, decompiling is easy for malicious actors looking to steal your IP or tamper with your software. That's where GuardSquare comes in. GuardSquare provides the highest level of mobile app security for Android and iOS applications and SDKs. Their advanced tools integrate seamlessly into your CI/CD pipeline. We're talking polymorphic, multi-layered code hardening techniques and automated runtime application self-protection paired with mobile application security testing and real-time threat monitoring to deliver the highest level of mobile app security without compromise. Don't leave your hard work exposed. Secure your mobile applications today. Go to guardsquare.com to learn more. Thanks again to GuardSquare for sponsoring. Couldn't do this without them. Outside of that, I will be at B-Sides Cache Valley. That is September 18th, so it's a few weeks away. And also at SaintCon with Ken, of all people. I do have some queries for Ken. I'm not going to put him on the spot. I'm helping run the AppSec community at SaintCon. So if you are going to be there, come on by or let us know. I'm sure we'll do some sort of a happy hour get together, whatever it is. Happy hour is a fraught term considering we're going to be in Provo, Utah. So it'll be, yeah, it'll be a
Oh,
get
no.
together no matter what. But yes.
Wait, is that a do they not serve any alcohol, or how does that?
No, they do. They do. There's like one small dive bar and anyway, like you just have to come experience it, Ken. I don't have any other way to If if you've been to Saint Con before, you probably have a good idea.
Interesting.
Interesting. We can take that discussion offline, or maybe we'll take that into Slack somewhere and have that discussion.
Yeah, I mean, mine makes me go to a special store to buy it. So
Yeah, that's
each thing
true.
has got its own
Yes.
weird little things about hang up about
Yep,
alcohol.
it does. Yeah. It's not necessarily a dry county in that way, right? Like, but there is a special store. I mean, it's just Utah's got its own its own special handling of of alcohol. So, not that that's what the podcast is about today, but hey, we can go wherever we want, right? I did want to start though, like with this paper that Brian put into Slack about It's the academic paper from a bunch of the guys at 1Password on vulnerability patching and how frontier models actually don't necessarily do what you expect, right? I'm going to go back to the beginning. Our experience with patching and with coding is that frontier models do a pretty decent job. They can code things, especially with the right plan in place, the right specifications. They're being driven by a senior engineer that knows how to architect things. They do a fairly decent job. The issue that we have is overconfidence in what these frontier models are actually pushing out. So the research here is analyzing patches created by frontier models to solve security issues and how well and how effective those models were in, number one, solving those issues, but also, number two, not introducing new issues or even additional security vulnerabilities based on the instructions that were provided to them, and then comparing the results across all of the different models that are out there, or the frontier models that are out there. My takeaway from this is, and here we'll go to the very start of this is, okay, it's, you know, flawed, right? Like, is their understanding. And these are the common failure modes of security patches that are being, that are resulting from having LLMs actually go in and be the ones that fix these. And if you've dealt with patching and coding using Codex or Claude Code or one of the AI agents at this point, this should not be surprising to you. The number of times that a patch generated by one of these frontier models, whether it is, you know, the latest and greatest, whether it's one that's, you know, a year old, whatever it is, the number of times that it doesn't quite meet the standards of what I asked for is, I mean, it's pretty common. So it's interesting to see the actual numbers associated with this specific to security patches. And I know, Ken, I was going to ask you specifically, as you are dealing with client requests, right, or customer requests to actually have your agents start to submit patches or generate patches, what sort of results are you seeing coming out of the models to, you know, to actually create these vulnerability patches? Like, what are the results that you're seeing? I know you've got harnesses around like multi-layered checks and other things that they probably didn't dig into here. But what sort of results do you see when having frontier models actually create patches for you?
Yeah. Sorry. Apologies. I'm a little tired. I'll try to. Yeah.
I know. I've been through a lot there, so I know I'm kind of putting you on the spot as I've been talking through different things.
No, it's fine. I just. Okay, there's so many thoughts in history here, but so philosophically, our company does not do auto remediation. We do and we don't, meaning like the way we do remediation is through guidance and literally like guidance, like guiding AI editors is the primary way that we do remediation, meaning like a AI IDE polls for if there's some recommendations, and if there is, like, it goes and, you know, it follows our recommendations. It uses the artifacts that we've given it to go and do some remediation. But I have to explain that a bit. And there's a lot of opinions here. So that's the only form of auto remediation currently that we offer. And we've been asked so many times, can you just like have a button I can click and it just like fixes everything for me, basically. And there are companies in our space that definitely do that, or at least, you know, purport to do that. And there are also dedicated companies, and this is where I got to talk about those dedicated companies for a second. There's also dedicated companies like I'm thinking of like Pixie, for instance, is one of those I could think of. Mob, M-O-B-B, and some others. But those are the two I'll just kind of name that I'm most familiar with. Even those two companies, when they started and when their products were launched, LLMs were not in a place where they could use them to do auto remediation. This is important because I had asked them about this, and I won't tell you everyone who I talked to, but I talked to quite a few people, and basically the gist was, at least one of them was using like some, I don't know, like, it's a query language of some kind, but it wasn't an LLM. There was some semantic reasoning introduced. I say reasoning, you know, quote unquote, but for the most part, it was not LLM driven. Now it's easier to just build like LLM driven solutions, right? And so you see even more and more companies, especially like I said, ones in our space, who are like, oh yeah, we just bolt that on and we just do that as well. Mm-hmm. And that is true, that it is easier to build patches, but to the problem is like, yeah, to build correct patches is a whole different other thing. And that's where I'll get into like my own personal feelings about all this.
Well, I want to call that out as you're talking through that, right? Because the questions that they were attempting to answer with this paper are interesting, because these are the challenges I'm sure you're going to talk through, right? Like, number one, how effective are LLMs at producing patches without altering the application's behavior? I struggle with this immensely. I'll just say that, right? You know, like the way when we're utilizing LLMs, the unintended consequences are huge. Do the patches they generate actually mitigate the vulnerabilities in questions? Do they actually like fix, you know, patch the software correctly? That's hard too. And how frequently do they introduce new vulnerabilities, right? Like, those are the three questions. And that, you know, this is great to actually see this academic research around it. Sorry. That seems to be where you're going, right, Ken? Like with the, you know, the altering the behavior and the liability of doing that. Granted, we're more comfortable with the LLMs, you know, Claude Code. Everybody's using Claude Code and Codex and Py.dev and, you know, take your pick as far as which, you know, agent they are using. So we're more comfortable with the AI agents actually doing those changes for us. But I can see that from your perspective, especially, like, you know, we have access to the code. We could generate a patch using an LLM, but that was not what we set out to do. So the expertise to creating, like, number one, the test, knowing what can and cannot be changed, what can and cannot be break, on top of I'm introducing code into a third party system that can run, and the liability that introduces for us as a third party gets to be very big. Anyway, so sorry, go ahead with that. Dario's coming in, so yeah.
Yeah, I was just reading that. It's funny. That unreleased me. That's hilarious. I don't know. I'll just speak freely. I'm not even trying to organize my thoughts here. Look, the deal is, like, there are certain vendors who and companies that produce like hot patches. Some of them say they do all of them. Some of them say, hey, we are going to stick to like only easy patches. Like, if this is like a, I don't know, change this from like a interpolated to not interpolated query, for instance, something very basic, then they'll do it. But anything more than that, basically anything that like is like more than like a one line, two line change or whatever, like, we're not even going to bother with. So some of them do that, but the thing that's driving it, what is driving it? I guess that's the real question, right? What is driving auto remediation? And there's probably a lot of things that are driving it, but I just get annoyed because we talk about like, oh, we're going to do runtime verification, we're going to do reachability, we're going to do this. Like, whatever. And it's always like, there's like a root cause that's being overlooked. And we're like trying to take some strategy and employ it instead of looking at the root cause. And I think when I look at the root cause here, tools that produce a ton of findings, that's obvious, or just having a lot of different tools in general and having a lot of different findings, that's managing that backlog. That's going to be something. Or it could be not the tools that are at fault. It could be that culturally your developers are not, I don't know, fixing issues. So that could be another reason. Maybe it's a culture issue where it's like not about tools, but it's just about people not fixing things. And so now you're like, oh, I just want somebody to fix all the things immediately. And we could talk through each one of these and their problems. There are the problems with using auto remediation to tackle those underlying root causes. I'd say the third one would also be, so we talked about, I should explain too, like I'm super tired today for listeners. So my apologies, but so first one, like I said, would be tools. Second one would be people not doing things. I think third would be the fear around Mythos and, just generally speaking, models that will allow attackers to find all the things and find them quicker, then you can fix them and all that fun stuff. So we got to do auto remediation. I'm sure, like I said, there's more than those three reasons for sure. But like each one of those has their own problem, right? If I have a culture problem, I have a culture problem. I don't have like a, okay, now shove this button in front of people so they do like auto remediation PRs and open them. That's going to work. Like, well, of course it's not going to work. That's insane. If your tools are the problem because you have either too many tools or your tools you're using are too noisy, why aren't you fixing that problem? Why are you going after auto remediation, right? And if the third one's like just pure fear, I mean, that's just silly in general to have any decision made based off of fear. I never see good reasons for why people want. And also like, I question, how do people see this working? And I'm not saying like, if there is somebody listening who's like, you know what, Ken, you're getting it wrong on this one. Auto remediation totally works. I have done it inside my organization. I want to tell people how we did auto remediation. By God, please come argue with me. Please tell me how I'm wrong. I'm happy to hear it. I really am. I mean that. I'd really like a case study for why like this has worked in someone's org. Because the way I actually see it working is like when people ask that question, it's mainly like a psychological, do I have that option? Because I can't imagine a world in which that would ever work. And I'll explain why. I've seen this. I depend about it. Let's look at Dependabot. Okay.
Yeah.
Dependabot, what people don't realize is that was us at GitHub internally that built that internally at GitHub for GitHub internally. We already knew before that ever went public that this wouldn't be like, there were going to be issues with people accepting those Dependabot PRs, right? But it became a product. And I can honestly look around and say, I can't tell you how many orgs I've talked to, worked with, where I can go in and I can go and look at their pull requests right now and see like open Dependabot. And they're like, yeah, we just don't care. It's just not, it's there, but like not a big deal, right? So I have historical precedence to say like auto patching is not a great approach always, right? And it's not to say you can't do it right. This isn't saying like auto patching. And I guess we should, this is also why in the beginning I kind of differentiated. There are certain companies, the two I'd mentioned, that started off not using LLMs to build fixes. In fact, talking to both their Eaton from Mob and one of the employees at Pixie, not Arshan, but I bet you Arshan would say the same thing, which is like, yeah, LLMs screw up enough that you need to have like a hybrid solution, which a lot of us who have been doing this since the beginning,
we know this.
Tell you, yeah, you need a hybrid solution. It can't just be pure LLM based. But in any case, they would tell me like, hey, like here's all the ways in which AI screws this up. Here's why we built ours this way, that and the other. And I'm like, yeah, that totally makes sense. I can totally see it. And I think, anyways, I'm sorry, this is a long ramble, but the general gist is I don't see a world in which you're just like, yeah, click a button, open a bunch of PRs and all these repos for these findings we created, and then like allow, I don't know, either humans or AI or a combination of the two to go and just like submit or fix or whatever, merge these in, and then that's just going to end well. Like, I just don't, just doesn't, like, you and I have done this, like, that doesn't work. So
yeah.
Why are we going about it this way?
Exactly. I mean, this is the same ask that honestly we've had for the last 20 years. When we come in as like AppSec consultants, as security consultants, we find vulnerabilities in code, right? So you and I have been doing code review for however many years at this point and teaching people how to do that. And the response has always been this, well, like, you have access to the code. Can you just not give me a patch to fix that? And like, we've always couched it because we're developers and we understand there are unintended consequences that go in to fixing even a simple one-line change. Especially to Brian's point, when you don't have all the context of how the application runs, what the environment looks like, and where, you know, where this code actually, what this affects, basically. And so even though over time we've started to give people what we call like patch level remediation advice, I have never included that as a patch. It's typically in a report, in Markdown, in something else, with the caveat that your developers need to take this and make sure that it meets company standards before they actually implement it. Because of the implications when you go about this. And I mean, LLMs are going to do whatever you ask them to do, just like your developers are going to do whatever you ask them to do. But if they don't understand it, and this goes back to the LLM is a junior developer. They're going to get sidetracked. They're going to make mistakes. They're going to lose focus. No matter how much context you give them, they're going to ignore certain pieces of advice. And that's exactly what this team at 1Password has found here, right? Like, how good are LLMs generally at fixing vulnerabilities? They only successfully fixed 26% of the vulnerabilities without any sort of ill side effects. So 1 in 4 was okay. That's pretty standard, right? For a junior developer or somebody else across the career that like I have had and what I see as people try to attempt to fix these vulnerabilities. Because how many times do you go back, you know, in the past, 1 year later, and you're like, hey, guess what? We found whatever it is. Okay, cross-site scripting on this one page, right? And the developers go in and fix cross-site scripting on that one page, but there is a bypass that's associated with that cross-site scripting vulnerability or the fix.
Yeah.
I mean, I would argue 75% of the time, it's probably pretty valid in my experience. So it doesn't matter who's fixing that vulnerability. There's going to be that problem. So the fact that that's been our experience for the last 20 years, it makes sense that LLMs have that same problem since they are trained on the data from the last 20 years that exists and is out there. I'm not surprised. Yeah.
Yeah. But like it's not. Yeah. So yes, it could make mistakes. It could whatever, but there's also things it doesn't even like you could not to say this isn't something that couldn't be overcome, but like, think about this, right? When we give out findings, even if it doesn't forget severity, right? Forget exploitability, forget all the attributes. Sometimes there's just things that they're hard to make tangible, right? And there are reasons why maybe I won't work on something, meaning like I may just be like, hey, that bug is not something I'm going to work on. Great. Thanks for the auto remediation. This isn't what I want. And it could be something as simple as, well, that's talking about something in JavaScript and we're removing that JavaScript, you know, framework in the future and replacing it with X. And so we know we're doing that in 3 months. AI doesn't know we're doing that in 3 months. This finding isn't really like a problem today. It can wait 3 months. Well, we're just going to not even, you know, it's things like that where it's like, that's why I say like auto remediation is such a brute force, like just the way that I've seen it done, it's just sort of like, yeah, here, now you take this and you go and you fix it, you know, or you merge it in, you merge this in. And it's just like, it's such a barbaric way to do it. I feel like it's just not, it's not something I would feel comfortable doing to developers, and a way I would feel employed. I wouldn't feel great about employing systems in that way.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, we've got some comments from Bobby and Brian, right, in chat, right? Like, you know, the Rogue one that I posted up there is great, right? Like, I think that'll be the encapsulation of this episode. But from what Bobby's seen, right, like the toil work goes to junior folks, right? You think about most development organizations, and the developers that are tasked with patching are usually those that are the least familiar with the code base, because those are considered to be low risk, right? Like tasks, I guess, as you know, in most organization. So you're looking to offload that to the LLM with similar results, apparently, or without, you know, without checks on top of that, you're going to get what you kind of deserve there, because you don't have the same level of scrutiny over that. Yeah.
I have a question for you though, an opinion. So like Greg, my old boss at GitHub had this, I always wondered why he didn't have us. There were times where I could easily like submit a pull request to fix something. In fact, I think a couple times at GitHub, I had to submit some emergency code to fix something, like I said, an emergency to like get it into prod. But very, again, no more than two times throughout almost 6 years of being there. The reason is that Greg was like, he had this his philosophy that we actually want developers to know like what the problem is and think through it, and then think through that solution. And just think through it, just have that cognitive load, not ignore the cognitive load, the opposite, take on the cognitive load, like ingrain, get that memory ingrained in you, understand this. And the idea being should help that person and build that person's, you know, knowledge and experience in that way. But also gets the team kind of involved, the engineering team. Now in this world where code's cheap, people are slinging it all over the place. Nobody cares about, you know, hey, if it doesn't work that great, who cares? I can use burn some tokens and use AI to build some, you know. Do you think that still applies in today's world? You know, do you still think that it's important
yes,
that developers take a look at how to actually fix it?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's going to be at a higher level, right? Like, but I kind of go back to this discussion that we've been having over the last month or so about how, and the discussion we had with Jivan about how software engineering principles still apply. So it might not be that you're necessarily cutting the code and you're looking for, you know, printf statements or whatever it is that exist, but you need to know where those sharp edges are in order to actually fix them and make sure that what's coming out of your juniors or your LLMs is appropriate for from a security correctness perspective, right? So I would argue that it is still the case. You still want those engineers involved that are actually responsible for the code base. The second that we take away that responsibility, that's where, you know, AI slop starts to get worse and worse, and you're going to have problems further on down the road if it's not matching your company's expectations, right? Like it all goes back to the same argument that we had previously when we provided those patch level remediations to clients is, you want your organization to take that spin and actually implement it because of the context that is there. And that goes to the point I've got on the screen, what Brian was talking about as well. Richer context helps. The more context that you have about an application, the better off it's going to be. But it has limits, and you only have so much context before the LLMs. We know they start to get distracted when, you know, too much context is provided and they focus on the wrong things. And so there is a plateau to how much data we can actually provide to them. And that's going to be any person as it is, but you want to lean into that as well to the discussion that we're having here. It's just not the silver bullet that people think it is. And I like the research that's coming out here that's like, guess what? There are mistakes that these LLMs are making that has serious security consequences you need to be aware of if you are trying to push this direction.
Well, this is one of many reasons I got annoyed at that Anthropic AI SDLC playbook, which, by the way, I am dropping an article about all the ways in which they are wrong, and I'm annoyed this week. But in any case, that was kind of like that. So 5.4, where it says incorrect guidance leads to correctness collapse. And it talks about like taking in reports from SaaS tools and bug bounty reports or other AI agents and then creating patches. So basically creating patches for things that might be wrong. But if you get to the bottom, it says this bodes especially poorly for the notion of a fully automated AI discovery to AI patching pipeline without human vetting in between the bug hunter and the patcher models. All right, so this goes back to like exactly one of the many problems I had with the whole AI SDLC playbook from Anthropic is that, no, these AI systems are screwed up, man. They make a lot of mistakes. It's okay, they're pretty good, right? But they make a lot of mistakes. And they definitely deserve attention and definitely shouldn't be just AI driven. And why I say that is like, if it's not, well, for a few reasons, but if it's not, if we're talking about, just to keep this succinct, if it's a system you're managing, it probably shouldn't just be AI driven, meaning like the signals that you input shouldn't be gathered necessarily probabilistically. But yeah, it doesn't. That's a little bit, that's me getting into the weeds a little bit. I'm going to zoom out and just say that whether it's the signals that you're putting into AI, whether it's whatever it might be, the models that you're using, the tasks that they're performing, the whatever, like, and you have effectively, I've talked about this so much, evaluations all along the way. Well, you're going to have adjustments all along the way based off of what your evaluations are finding. And that's why it was really annoying reading that AI playbook, SDLC playbook from them, because basically it was like managing outputs of these tools and managing markdown files and things of that nature. And I'm like, you've got to be kidding me. Do you think that that's like the only world we're going, or the only thing we're going to play in this, or the only task that, God, I can't even talk, Seth. Do you think that's the only thing we're going to do in this new world? You're insane.
Yeah.
You're insane. There's going to be so much for us to do in terms of vetting and evaluations and improvements and modifying signals and just everything that we do, or everything these systems do, are going to need us involved to make sure they don't go south. Because I'm telling you, I work in this every single day. And the scary thing is, the more I work with these systems, the more I sit back and I say, my God, I hope people understand how good they are at tricking them. I mean,
yeah,
they're, well, today, let me give you an example. Today, I actually had to put, so in our thing, in our tool, you can do a full repo scan, right? And you can download the report. Today, yeah. I had to have a ticket filed and we've opened a pull request. It might even be in prod now, where we have to put at the end of our reports now, instructions for different, because here's what people are doing. They're like, hey, I just ran this tool and I just ran Codex security or Claude security or whatever tool. Let me evaluate these two tools. Oh my God, that's so flawed. It's so flawed to use AI to evaluate different tools, especially if both those are agentically powered tools, but still very, very bad. So I literally had to put like 8 different ways in which they screw up and to not make those mistakes inside of our reports, just because, like I said, people will take the reports, download them, and just feed them off to AI and be like, you do the work. And I'm like, well, no, stop. They're so convincing that they'll tell you things that'll make you feel like they know what they're talking about. That's the hard part, is that it's so hard to communicate. Like, yes, they're good. People don't understand the nuance of, yes, it can be really good, but it also can be very bad in very discrete and specific ways. And you don't, because of the goodness, it's hard sometimes to understand the badness. And yeah. Anyway, I'm just getting more and more skeptical the longer I work with these systems about
how well. No, I'm, I'm with you, because the amount of like deterministic tooling that I've put into place, like for Surveyor specifically, and I know you have, you know, on the dry run side as well, to account for the bad responses that actually come out of the LLM is non-trivial, right? It feels like magic. It tells you that it's magic. It comes back very in a very convincing manner. We've trained these models to sound like experts. So of course it's going to sound like an expert when you ask it about, you know, coding in general, or it, you know, or security topics. And yeah, if it's enough to pass muster when reviewing that output, the likelihood that a human's going to trust it increases significantly, even though under the hood it's not patching what you expected it to patch. It's, you know, writing new code to do to perform certain operations when you didn't want it to do that. It's touching code bases that may or may not have an impact. It's getting distracted because it's seeing other patterns in the code that are similar to the patch that you're trying to correct here. And these are all examples of things that I've dealt with in the last week, trying to get an agent to do different things for me specifically. Even though it sounds really good, like the spec that we wrote up initially, you know, in conjunction with these models sounded really good. The fact that it doesn't necessarily solve it in the way that I want it to is the learning process that I've had to go through over and over again. Because my inclination is to trust what's coming out of it. And then the second I start to verify, I realize that it indeed has gone off the rails in ways that were unintended.
Yeah, they're not perfect, yeah. And neither are we. And I think we're trying to, humans aren't perfect, AI isn't perfect, and we have to like just acknowledge that on both fronts. Definitely shoving, and I will say, like, even this is a great, I mean, good job, guys. You know, I definitely have heard, however, people poke some holes in some of the testing methodology here, and you know,
yeah,
my own opinion is that ultimately they're right. Like I don't love auto remediation in the way that it's proposed, not in this paper. I'm saying just in general, the way I tend to hear this is like, yeah, if we find a bug, we just submit a pull request to fix it. And it's like, man, that is so flawed, like in so many ways. And on top of that, even if you don't agree with any of this, even if you're just like, no, I just disagree with everything you say, whatever, totally fair. Okay, fine. But you cannot argue with the fact that code churn equals risk, period. Every time you change a line of code, there is risk, period. You can't even argue with that. That's just a fact. So, you know, extrapolate that out to like, you know, taking findings from all these different tools or from wherever and, you know, just throwing auto fixes on it. Of course, that's going to be a bad strategy.
Yeah. Yep. I love this recommendation section, right? Like just the first, you know, I mean, the first is like actually try this against your own code base to see how it does. But then the second one is human domain expertise remains a necessary prerequisite of reliable patches. You've got to determine what that is for you, right? But I'm with you. Like none of these like research papers are necessarily going to be complete, right, from a, you know, coverage perspective or whatever it is. But the findings themselves still stand up in my experience, right? I don't know. Do you want to talk any more about this, or should we jump to that other article that you had? I don't know necessarily how to put a bow on this outside of be careful, right? Yeah.
No, I mean, obviously AI is writing code all day long. It's fine, but it's different when a human's involved versus when a human's not involved. And if a human's not involved, the bow I'd put on this is that if a human's not involved, if something you're doing, whether it's auto remediation or auto anything, if it's autonomous, there has to be observations, there has to be evaluations, there has to be a human doing quality assurance, basically, and management. Yep. And like that. So yes, fine. If you want to do auto remediation, you really really love that, fine, go do that. but don't do it without humans involved somehow. Like, that would be my bow
on that. Yeah. Yep. Yep. I mean, there's got to be some sort of a stopgap, a check. You've got to have that domain expertise in there. Because if you don't, you're just, I mean, that's what they've proven out here. If you don't have that human in the loop actually doing those validations and even some sort of, you know, check on the patches themselves and what's being generated, the likelihood is only 1 in 4, 25%, that it's going to solve the patch, number one. Number two, that there aren't going to be unintended consequences, right? Like, again, we start to, you know, mathematically have worse results over time, the more of this that we depend on. Okay, so with that, do you want to talk about that snowflake vuln? Or do you want to argue whether or not, you know, what is that?
No.
Whether,
so I'll, yeah. Oh, wait, go what ahead. Do we want to argue yeah. about? I can argue.
Yep, yep. Let's, yeah. No, this is good. Let's dig into this snowflake vuln. And you're going to have to talk to this a little bit more because I didn't get to, I know you were able to get through this article. I was looking more at that Frontier Labs one.
Yeah, technically, I mean, I'll pull it up and I can, here, let me just pull it up. I don't, the technical bits we've talked about exact version. I mean, we've literally talked about, this is why I'm bringing it up because, all right, first let me share the screen so then I can talk. And no matter how much caffeine I take today, I might just have to find actual rest. It's tough. It's tough. I should say it's tough when your teenager is school starts real early.
Yeah, it is.
Yep. Put it that way, man. Got to get up so early. Anyways, all right. So back to AppSec stuff. Basically, Wiz Red Agent. Wiz has this thing they call Red Agent. It's probably like a agentic red teaming tool or something. I don't know. But anyways, that thing went and found a vulnerability, and it was in Snowflake's one of Snowflake's workflow files. It was introduced into pull request. It was introduced by an AI coding tool. I don't know which one. I don't know if Copilot was also the author, but okay, this is why it's interesting. So, so it both discovered the, oh, and the actual vuln. Let's actually, sorry, before I get into the takeaways, the technical bit. So basically there's an issue title, right? And we've talked about this before. We've had examples of this shown on the podcast before, even where it's literally the GitHub issue title, which in this case is the same exact thing, is ran. And it's got system commands in the title, and voila, you've got RC. So what had happened was inside of this PR, it was updating the workflow file, and it sounds like, oh yeah, co-authored by AI. So Copilot auto fix powered by AI. Yep, cool. So that's why they said, so Copilot authored the PR, it sounds like, and reintroduced the vulnerability. Basically what happens is they take the title, they run an echo on it, bypass it. I think this said pattern allows for a bypass where, you know, system commands can get placed into the issue title and executed via the echo call there. And that's supposed to be the vulnerability. I believe that's supposed to be the vulnerability. Or maybe it's down here, I don't know. So, but that is the gist. You take the title, you echo it in, and they were able to find a way to bypass the little said pattern. Now, this is removing safe behavior and actually introducing a regression. So this is actually regressing. Apparently this was fixed before Copilot was trained on the insecure code. So it actually just wrote the insecure code here. Then I guess the other notable part about this is that Copilot obviously missed, since Copilot's not a security review tool. Like, that's the one thing I will say is Copilot does occasionally find a security thing, but it doesn't do that. So I don't know if that was fair to call that out and say, well, Copilot didn't find the security issue. It's like, well, it doesn't do that. It's supposed to find functional issues. Plus it also wrote the code. So, you know, again, it's that thing of if the thing writing the code is also the thing reviewing the code, usually problems exist. So there's that. But anyways, I think it was what was kind of notable about all this is that basically, you know, because it was in the training set, it reintroduced and regressed. It wasn't caught by any of their tooling. And they talk about the actual issue more on this article. And I believe that was kind of their takeaway effectively, right? Which is like, so the key takeaway was AI code generation demands rigorous oversight to the point of the entire freaking topic that we just covered.
Yeah.
I mean, kind of right there, you know. And then, collapsing discovery windows. The vulnerability was live for only 5 days before an automated agent discovered and validated it. Yeah, that's the world we're living in. But that's the world we're living in. And then, so security intent can be lost when safer code patterns are not explicitly enforced. Yeah, I mean, that's 100%. You know, these are the kinds of things that you store as a memory for context later. If you're, you know, an agentic security tool, you say, hey, yep, you know, we can't have this stuff. And then you enforce it with policies so that it doesn't get introduced in future pull requests. So that's kind of the way the new world works. And you know, that's most of the agentic AppSec tools these days. But yeah, I don't know. Like, is there anything else you wanted to really like cover? I don't know. It's not like it's a super amazing hack. It's not like it's a super amazing breach. This is all pretty vanilla stuff. And it seems like AI pretty much all around from introducing it to regressing and introducing it to not detecting it to detecting it with a security focused agent. All around, this is all AI.
It is. And this is the world. So to Brian's point, right? Like, this is the world that we live in. His point is question about where are we going to find enough secure quality code to actually train an AI model on is a valid question. Given the amount of insecure code that's out there that we've trained these models on, the likelihood that they are going to introduce security vulnerabilities increases based on the model itself, even when you say, yeah, and do this securely, since it only can contain so much context. It's only going to take that into account in specific situations. Maybe it, you know, doesn't necessarily think that that's a XSS vulnerability or, you know, an RCE in this case for whatever reason, or it wasn't given that instruction. Like, the likelihood that this stuff is going to occur is going to increase. And then it's also going to be detected. Somebody's going to get a payout. And that speaks to the next article that we're going to talk about, right? But it's turtles all the way down is what we're running into, right? Like, it's all AI generated, AI detected, AI paid out, AI auto fixed. And then the likelihood that this will be an issue with the next submission or somewhere else within these actions is, I mean, it increases, right? And there is a positive signal to this because it gives work to the AI to actually do. And this is where my cynicism starts to come in as far as, do the frontier labs actually want to only produce secure code? Because the likelihood that they have additional work and additional token spend when they produce code that is insufficient or doesn't meet standards or whatever it is increases significantly, and there's more churn associated with that. There's more token spend, there's more money from an investor perspective. So there's not necessarily incentive for the AI labs themselves to produce models that only produce correct code. I know that's a very cynical take on it, but that's the feel of what I get when I see something like this. I don't know your take.
Do you think it's intentional? I don't even think it's intentional. Yeah, I just think the reality is it's just like humans have limitations. These entities have limitations, and we're just seeing that. I mean, that's, you know, it doesn't surprise me that was in the training set. Nope. doesn't surprise me that, like, and do I think there's any? No, I think genuinely, it's sort of like, unless there's, actually, I'm not sure. I think that because there's, sorry, in my head, there's also this balance of token spend to effective delivery, right? So it's like, yeah, there could have been several other turns of different operations done when it generated that workflow code to try and secure it. There's a cost with that. There's a cost of a human being did it time-wise and cognitive load-wise, meaning a human being trying to fix this issue and, or excuse me, write this feature and not introduce a security issue. There's just imperfections. There's just imperfections, and there's going to be imperfections. And for us to do everything right all the time, whether that's AI or human beings, is like just not realistic. That's why I kind of think it's odd when people are like, oh, are you worried that, like, or not odd? It's actually a fair question. And I know, like, us in AppSec, we all say we want code to be written securely 100% of the time coming out of the gate. So we could have different jobs and do something different, I guess. I don't know. Yeah, that's always been the goal, but we're not there. I mean, close to there is the nicest way I could say that, but yeah.
And if anything, this, like, the advent of this vulnpocalypse, right? Like, is showing that we're not going to get there for a long time. Right.
Yeah. I think that's absolutely fair. I don't know. Like, I have so many thoughts. It's just, it's hard without writing things down for me, because there's so many things I can say. There's things I want to say. There's things that I can't say as well. For sure. And, kind of just leave it at that, I guess.
Well, yeah, we can leave it there. The last article that I was referencing, and maybe we'll just drop this really quick, was from Dark Reading, right? And this is that the vulnpocalypse is repricing the bug bounty economy. It's interesting, again, to see the data behind it, that the number of issues that are popping into these different programs is actually devaluing what used to be critical or high severity signal. And, you know, who was it? The HackerOne CEO is talking about the report volume has doubled year over year. We're definitely seeing that. I see that in my own reports, as we're using AI to help assist in generating findings. It has increased the number of findings that we report, right? Which means that it's a better value for clients overall, because we're identifying more things, we're reducing risk over time. But it also means on the bug crowd world that you are reducing the amount of money available to each of the findings in and of themselves. So, you know, where you typically had a pot of, you know, one company, if you take it, you know, just to be easy, you know, they have $10,000 in their pot to pay for bug bounty findings for 3 months or whatever it is. If they have double the amount of vulnerabilities that are reported at the same criticality, that reduces the amount that they can actually pay out based on the budget that's actually there, right?
It's sure simple, it's not economics. Like other factors like popularity of bug bounty programs increasing, or like their maybe increasing available attack surface inside a bug bounty program. I sometimes wonder about shit like this, because it sounds nice on its head, but then you like dig in and you find out, to be fair, if any business is doubling year over year, like, all right, that's notable. It's awesome. I'm sure it's not just, but you know, I mean, I don't know. I'm always a little, again, you talk about skepticism and cynicism. I'm always a little like, is it really AI that's causing? And I'm sure it is, like, no freaking doubt that AI is causing some of this. But really, I mean, to be fair, in the fall of 2025 would be about when I would say we started seeing, as a community, I'd say more and more like uptake. because it's like now harnesses were built for script kiddies that made it easier to do this stuff, right? They didn't have to build their own stuff anymore. Again, circa, I guess, fall of 2025. So if it's year over year, every, you know what I mean? That's all I'm saying. Surely it can't just be AI.
No, I mean, it's not just AI, but I think it's the use of automation and the use of AI that is driving it. Because to your point, right, like those researchers that have put out harnesses to use to identify vulnerabilities and have open sourced those issues, that's been dropped into the back pocket of the bug bounty researchers. So now they're utilizing that across multiple different targets, multiple different programs. The likelihood that they're going to get duplicates starts to increase, but the likelihood that they're going to find more things with the use of those has also increased. And it's become easier and easier, right? Like, not a day goes by that I don't see another harness that's been released on GitHub for, you know, some specific nuanced vulnerability. And that doesn't mean that harness is great, but it does increase the traffic and it does increase the likelihood that there are going to be reports associated with those new harnesses as they start to get released in the open source that's out there, which is great from a risk reduction perspective, but it also means there's only so much money that these companies can spend on bug bounty vulnerabilities. It's going to decrease those values over time. And that's the argument that's being made here, is there is a decrease in this because of the vulnapocalypse and the number of vulnerabilities that are being discovered. Yeah, I guess that's my take on it. It could be wrong, but that's my take currently. Well, it'll change in a week.
What do you think their strategy should be to deal with this?
Do you mean like the bug bounty platforms, or do you mean researchers, or are you asking about the companies themselves?
No, I would say not the researchers, the companies and the bug bounty platforms.
Ooh, that'd be interesting. We should talk with, Andrew or somebody and ask him what they're actually doing for this. In general, I think their payment comes from running the programs themselves for companies. So they're not necessarily at risk of being devalued, because it's becoming more and more apparent that you have to run at least something in order to stay on top of the number of vulnerabilities that are coming in, right? If you don't have some sort of way to manage those and to prioritize what's actually being fixed or paid out, the likelihood that you're going to get exploited just increases. So in general, I think a company has to have some way to both triage and deal with the vulnerabilities as they pop in, number one, whether that's a bug bounty platform or dedicated, person, or at least some sort of process that is responsive so the researchers feel like they're being given due diligence, that comes into play. And then number two, you need to be identifying this stuff yourself, right? Whether it is through some sort of agentic, whether you're using the same tooling that the bug bounty researchers are, like if you want to reduce that cost and, do away with the low hanging fruit, shall we say, so you're concentrating on the high prioritized items, then you've got to be taking care of the low hanging fruit. You've got to have some sort of process internally, whether that is using your own agentic harness and architectures or tooling to identify these issues before those tools go out, to actually tasking someone to be on top of it. I don't think there's any other way, right? Like nowadays you're going to get hit eventually based on the number of tools and agents that are out there actually scanning for these vulnerabilities. I don't have a good answer for you, Ken, then. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I think you do, because I think something you said made me think about like reducing scope. Because like as you expand scope, as you run a bug bounty program, you may, like we did, expand your scope as you get more comfortability with I cannot reach for words in my brain today. I really do need sleep. Yeah, I don't know what I was trying to say. Fucking can't think, man.
You've got to prioritize, right? If I'm working with a limited budget for a bug bounty and I'm getting too many vulnerabilities out there that are outside of the scope of what's really important to me, I'm probably scoping down to your point right now. I'm probably scoping down to my high priority applications. Put your agents on that first. Let's figure out what's going on there. And then we could, you know, expand the scope again. But I would be changing my scope. I'd be talking to, my management about, number one, we're draining our bug bounty budget more quickly than we expected. So let's concentrate that money to where it has the best results for us, as opposed to everything underneath the sun. That's where I start.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't envy having to run a bug bounty program right now. It's got to be really tough. Well, and also because, like, God, I remember how confident people that were wrong were.
Yes. Can
only imagine confidence is with AI telling them they're right.
Mm-hmm. So, and how smart they are. And yeah, exactly. All right. Well, we've been going for an hour. Interesting topics today. Always appreciate your insight, Ken. And
I don't know if today you should appreciate anything. Appreciate your insights.
I do. Yeah, it's all good. thanks to Brian, Bobby, everybody for interacting today. As always, we will continue the conversation. Let me see. I was going to give a shout out for next week. Who do we have on? I don't remember off the top of my head, and I promised that I would. So that's where I'm trying to look it up really quick.
Brian Lloyd.
Brian Lloyd from, let's see. Jeez, I can't remember. Where's Brian Lloyd from? That's not
Guard Square.
Oh, geez. That's my bad. That's right. Guard Square. He's going to be coming on. We've got a discussion with him later this week. You are correct. That'll be interesting. They've been sponsoring for a little bit now, and we'll be digging into some of the mobile strategies that they have to actually secure mobile applications. If you've been a follower of the podcast for a long time, you know that what a bear mobile testing actually is. So it'll be interesting to talk through the strategies and what they're doing with ProGuard as well. I'm excited for that one. That's going to be really great. So watch this space. Please come along next week as we talk about mobile testing. We haven't done that for a while. So it'll be a good conversation. Episode 334 next week. All right. Thanks again to everybody for listening today. And we will see you. Thanks to Guard Square for sponsoring and for coming on next week. And we will see everyone online.
Hey, everyone. Thank you. Yeah.